This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Way of the Wolf, Straight Line Selling, Master the Art of Persuasion, Influence, and Success. Written and read by Jordan Belfort.
Prologue: The Birth of a Sales System. What they say about me is true. I'm one of those natural-born salesmen who can sell ice to an Eskimo, oil to an Arab, pork to a rabbi, or anything else you can think of. But who really cares about that, right? I mean, unless you want to hire me to sell one of your products, my ability to close is basically irrelevant to you. Whatever the case, that's my gift. The ability to sell anything to anyone in massive quantities. And whether this gift comes from God or from nature, I really can't say. Although what I am able to say, with absolute certainty in fact, is that I am not the only person who was born with it. There are a handful of others who are sort of like me. The reason they're only sort of like me has to do with another precious gift I possess. A gift that's infinitely more rare and infinitely more valuable, and it offers a massive benefit to everyone, including you. What is this amazing gift? Quite simply, it's the ability to take people from all walks of life, regardless of age, race, creed, color, socioeconomic background, educational status, and level of natural sales ability, and turn that person into a world-class closer almost instantly. It's a bold statement, I know, but let me put it to you this way. If I were a superhero, then training salespeople would be my superpower, and there's not a soul on the planet who does it better than me. Now that sounded totally awful, right? I can only imagine what you're thinking right now. What a cocky bastard this guy is. So conceited, so damn full of himself. Let's throw the bastard to the wolves. Oh wait, he already is a wolf, isn't he? Actually, I'm an erstwhile wolf. But either way, I think it's time to formally introduce myself. I'm the Wolf of Wall Street, remember me? The one who Leonardo DiCaprio played on the silver screen? The one who took thousands of young kids who could barely walk and chew gum at the same time and turned them into world-class closers using a seemingly magical sales training system called the Straight Line? The one who tortured all those panic-stricken New Zealanders at the end of the movie because they couldn't sell me a pen the right way? You remember. On the heels of Black Monday, I took control of an irrelevant little brokerage firm named Stratton Oakmont and moved it out to Long Island to seek my fortune. And it was there, in the spring of 1988, that I cracked the code for human influence and developed that seemingly magical system for training salespeople. Its name was the Straight Line System, or the Straight Line for short, a system that proved to be so powerful and effective and so easy to learn that within days of inventing it, it brought massive wealth and success to anyone I taught it to. In consequence, thousands of young men and women began pouring into Stratton's boardroom looking to hop on the Straight Line gravy train and stake their claim in the American dream. For the most part, they were a decidedly average lot at best. Basically the sad, forgotten spawn of America's working-class families. They were kids who had never been told by their parents that they were capable of greatness, and any greatness that they naturally had in them had been literally conditioned out of them since the day they were born. By the time they made it into my boardroom, they were merely trying to survive, not to thrive. But in the post-straight-line world, none of that mattered anymore. Things like education and intellect and natural sales ability were mere trivialities that could be easily overcome. All you had to do was show up at my door, promise to work your ass off, and I would teach you the Straight Line System and make you rich. But alas, there was also a dark side to all this precocious success. You see, the system turned out to be almost too effective. It created freshly minted millionaires at such a ferocious clip that they ended up skipping over the typical life struggles that most young men and women go through that serve to build their characters. The result was success without respect, wealth without restraint, and power without responsibility. And just like that, things began to spiral out of control. And so it was that in the same way that a seemingly innocuous tropical storm uses the warm waters of the Atlantic to grow and build and strengthen and mutate until it reaches a point of such critical mass that it destroys everything in its path, the straight line system followed an eerily similar trajectory, destroying everything in its path as well, including me. Indeed, by the time it was over, I had lost everything. My money, my pride, my dignity, my self-respect, my children for a time, and my freedom. But the worst part of it all was that I knew I had no one to blame but myself. I had taken a God-given gift and misused it, and I had taken an amazing discovery and bastardized it. The straight line system had the ability to change people's lives in a dramatic way, leveling the playing field for anyone who'd been held back from achieving greatness due to an inability to effectively communicate their thoughts and ideas in a way that connected with other people and moved them to take action. And what did I do with it? Well, besides breaking a fair number of records for the consumption of dangerous recreational drugs, I used my discovery of the world's most powerful sales training system to live out every adolescent fantasy I'd ever had, while empowering thousands of others to do the same. So yes, I deserve exactly what I got, completely wiped out. But of course, the story doesn't end there. And how could it, after all? I mean, how could a system that created such massive wealth and success for anyone who learned it simply fade away into obscurity? It couldn't. And of course, it didn't. It started with the thousands of ex-Strattonites who, after leaving the firm, began spreading the system around, bringing a watered-down version of it to a dozen different industries. Yet no matter where they went or how watered-down the version was, learning even a fraction of the straight-line system was enough to take a struggling salesperson and turn them into a solid producer. Then I got involved. On the heels of two best-selling memoirs and a blockbuster Scorsese movie, I spread an undiluted version across the entire world to virtually every business and industry, from banking to brokerage to telco to the auto industry to real estate to insurance to financial planning to plumbers to doctors to lawyers to dentists to online marketers to offline marketers and basically everyone in between. As amazing as the results had been the last time around, this time they were even better. You see, before I began teaching the system again, I spent 2 full years going line by line through its code, taking every last nuance and pushing it to an even higher level of operational proficiency while ensuring that every last bit was grounded at the highest level of ethics and integrity. Gone were any high-pressure sales tactics, questionable language patterns, or even the slightest reference to closing a sale at all costs to simply earn a commission. All of these were purged from the system in favor of more elegant strategies. It was a painstaking process where no expense was spared and no stone left unturned. World-class experts were brought in to review every aspect of the system, from occupational psychologists to experts in content creation, best adult learning practices, and neurolinguistic programming. And what emerged in its place was something truly incredible. A system that was so powerful and effective, and that maintained such a high level of ethics and integrity, that I knew in my heart that the straight line system had finally evolved into what I always knew it could be, a money-making force for good. What I offer you now is a turnkey solution for applying the straight line system to any business or industry. For those of you in sales, or if you own your own business, this book will be a total game changer for you. It will show you how to shorten your sales cycle, increase your closing rate, develop a steady stream of customer referrals, and create customers for life. In addition, it will also offer you a paint-by-number formula for building and maintaining a world-class sales force. And for those of you who are not in sales, this book will be equally as valuable to you. You see, one of the costliest mistakes that civilians make is that they tend to think of sales and persuasion in traditional terms only, where there's a salesperson closing a deal. So they ask themselves, since I'm not in sales, what's the point of learning how to sell? Meanwhile, nothing could be further from the truth. Even if you're not in sales, you still need to become at least reasonably proficient at sales and persuasion. Otherwise, you're going to find yourself living a severely disempowered life. Selling is everything in life. In fact, either you're selling or you're failing. You're selling people that your ideas make sense, your concepts make sense, your products make sense. You could be a parent selling your kids on the importance of taking a bath or doing their homework. You could be a teacher selling your students on the value of education. A lawyer selling a jury on the innocence of your client. A pastor selling your congregation on the existence of God or Jesus or Muhammad or Buddha. A politician selling your constituency on the benefits of voting for a certain referendum. In short, selling applies to all people and all aspects of life, both business and personal. After all, at some point in our lives, we'll all have to sell ourselves to someone, a prospective partner, a future employer, a future employee, a future first date, and on and on. Then you have all the day-to-day business scenarios that fall outside of what we normally consider sales. An entrepreneur trying to raise venture capital or secure a line of credit at a bank. Selling your employees or someone you're courting to become an employee on the power and righteousness of your vision for the future. Negotiating a new lease for office space. Securing a better interest rate on your merchant account. Or negotiating better payment terms with a vendor. Again, it doesn't matter what line of work you're in or if it's business or personal. We're always trying to convey our thoughts and ideas and hopes and dreams in a way that not only moves people to take action, but that also gets us what we want in life too. That's what ethical persuasion is all about. And without that one linchpin skill, it is very difficult to achieve success at any reasonable level or live an empowered life. In fact, at the end of the day, that's what this book is really all about. By providing you with a simple, proven way to master the art of communication, you'll be able to move through life with far greater personal power and live a far more empowered life. Just always remember the words of Spider-Man's uncle from the first Spider-Man movie. With great power, he warned, comes great responsibility. This book will grant you that power. I urge you to please use it responsibly. One, cracking the code for sales and influence. Don't you guys get it? Every sale is the same. The first time I uttered those words to a room full of salesmen was on a Tuesday evening in 1988, and what I got in return was some very confused looks. There were looks that so much is said. What the hell are you talking about, Jordan? Every sale is not the same. Every sale is different. Our prospects all have different needs, different beliefs, different values, different objections, and different pain points. So how could every sale possibly be the same? In retrospect, I can see their point. In fact, I could see all their points. The points of the millions upon millions of people who have attended my straight-line seminars all over the world and who have cocked their heads to the side and narrowed their eyes skeptically when I got up on stage and said with absolute certainty that every sale is the same. After all, it seems like a rather far-fetched notion, doesn't it? I mean, even if you put aside the obvious points that I listed above, how could every sale possibly be the same? Take the countless number of goods and services for sale in the global marketplace. They too are all different. Take the personal financial situations of your prospects. They're all different too. And take the unique sets of preconceived notions that each prospect brings with them into the sale. Not just about your product, but also about you, about trusting salespeople in general, and about the decision-making process itself as it relates to buying. Again, they're all different. Indeed, when you take all the apparent differences that can pop up in a sale at any time, it comes as no surprise that only a tiny percentage of the population feels comfortable at the thought of entering a situation that requires sales and influence. The rest of the world actively shies away from it, despite knowing how absolutely crucial it is to the achievement of wealth and success. Even worse, among those very select few who do feel comfortable, only a tiny percentage of them will ever attain the status of being a top producer. The rest will plod along somewhere in the middle, stuck in the muck and mire of mediocrity and averageism. They'll earn just enough to keep selling worthwhile. After all, even a decent salesperson will make more money closing sales than in a non-sales related job, but they'll never experience the financial freedom of being a top producer. It will always remain just out of reach. It's a sad reality for sure, but such is the plight of any salesperson who believes that every sale is different. The discovery that hit me like an atomic bomb and led directly to the creation of the straight line system. My discovery didn't come about slowly. It came all at once during an emergency sales training session I held in Stratton's original boardroom. At the time, I had only 12 brokers working for me, and at this particular moment, precisely 7:15 p.m. on that very Tuesday evening, they were sitting directly across from me and wearing those confused, skeptical expressions that I would come to know so well. As the story goes, exactly 4 weeks prior to that, I'd stumbled upon an untapped niche in the retail stock market, which was selling $5 stocks to the richest 1% of Americans. For whatever reason, no one on Wall Street had ever tried it before. And when I tested the idea myself, the results were so incredible that I decided to completely reinvent the firm. At the time, Stratton was selling penny stocks to average moms and pops, and we were having massive success since the day the firm opened. In fact, by the end of our third month, the average broker, or Strattonite, as they like to call themselves, was already earning more than $12,000 in monthly commission, and one of them was earning more than triple that. That broker was none other than Danny Porish, my future junior partner who would end up being immortalized on the silver screen by a slimmed-down, buck-toothed version of Jonah Hill, who loosely portrayed him in the movie The Wolf of Wall Street. Whatever the case, Danny was the first person I'd ever taught how to sell penny stocks, and as luck would have it, he turned out to be a born salesman like me. At the time, we both worked at a small penny stock firm called the Investor Center, and Danny was my assistant. When I left to open Stratton, I brought Danny with me, and he'd been my right-hand man ever since. In fact, it was Danny who wrote that first massive buy ticket with a wealthy investor on the fifth day of the test. His commission on this one single trade was $72,000, an amount so incomprehensibly large that if I hadn't seen it for myself, I wouldn't have believed it. To give you some perspective, it was over 100 times greater than the average commission on a penny stock trade. It was nothing short of a total game changer. To this very day, I'll never forget the look on Danny's face when he walked into my office holding that golden buy ticket. And I'll also never forget looking out into the boardroom myself a few moments later, after I regained my composure, and seeing my entire future unfold right before my eyes. In that very instant, I knew that this would be the last day that Stratton ever sold penny stocks to anyone. What with the massive financial firepower that a wealthy investor could bring to bear, it simply didn't make sense to cold call average moms and pops ever again. It was as simple as that. All that was left to do was to teach the Strattonites how to close rich people, and the rest, as they say, would be history. Unfortunately, as they also say, easier said than done. As it turned out, training a bunch of barely post-adolescent nincompoops to go toe-to-toe with America's wealthiest investors was far more challenging than it could have ever possibly anticipated. In fact, it turned out to be totally fucking impossible. After 4 weeks of cold calling, the Strattonites hadn't closed a single new account. Not even one. Even worse, because it was my idea to make the switch, the brokers were holding me personally responsible for their current state of misery. In essence, They had gone from earning $12,000 a month to making $0 a month. And I had run out of ideas on how to train them. And make no mistake, I had tried everything. After failing miserably with my own system, I read through countless books on sales, listened to tapes, attended local seminars. I even flew clear across the country to Los Angeles, California, to attend a 3-day sales seminar that was purported to have the world's greatest sales trainers all under one roof. But again, I came up empty-handed. Disturbing as it was, after one full month of intelligence gathering, the most valuable piece of intelligence that I'd been able to gather was that my own system of training was far more advanced than anything else out there. And if that wasn't cutting it, where was I to go from there? I was starting to think that maybe it was just impossible. Perhaps the Strattonites were simply constitutionally incapable of closing rich people. They were too young and too uneducated to be taken seriously by them. Yet how would that explain the massive success that Danny and I were still having as we continued to dial through our leads? My personal closing rate had climbed to over 50% by now, and Danny's was in the low 30s. How could we all be dialing through the same leads, using the same script, pitching the same stock, and yet getting such dramatically different results? It was enough to make a person insane, or even worse, to make them jump ship. By the end of week 4, the Strattonites had basically given up. They were desperate to go back to the world of penny stocks and were teetering on the edge of mutiny. So there I was, at the front of the boardroom, desperate for a breakthrough. What I was about to realize, however, was that I actually just made one. Looking back at that moment now, standing before the brokers and trying to explain how every sale is the same, I would have never guessed how close I was to inventing the world's most powerful sales training system. You see, when I said that every sale is the same, what I meant that night, and what turned out to be one of the most profound ideas I've ever had, is that despite all those aforementioned differences, individual needs, objections, values, pain points, despite all that stuff, the same 3 key elements must still line up in any prospect's mind before you have a shot at closing them. Let me repeat that. The reason every sale is the same is because, despite all that individual stuff, the same 3 key elements still have to line up in any prospect's mind before you have a shot at closing them. And it doesn't matter what you're selling or how you're selling it, how much it costs or how much money the prospect has, and whether it's tangible or intangible or over the phone or in person. If in a single moment in time you can create these 3 crucial elements in a prospect's mind, then you have an excellent shot of closing. Conversely, if even one of them is missing, you have basically no shot at all. The 3 tens. We call these 3 core elements the 3 tens, with the context being a prospect's current state of certainty on a scale from 1 to 10. For example, if a prospect is currently at a 10 on the certainty scale, then it means he or she is in a state of absolute certainty at that moment. Conversely, if the prospect is currently at a 1, then they're in a state of absolute uncertainty at that moment. Now, in sales, when we talk about certainty, the first thing that pops into people's minds is certainty about the actual product being sold. In other words, before there's any chance of a prospect buying a product, they first have to be absolutely certain that the product makes sense to them, insofar as it filling their needs, eliminating any pain they might have, being good value for the money, and so forth. So, the first of the 3 tens is your product. The 3 tens. 1, the product, idea, or concept. In essence, your prospect must be absolutely certain that they love your product. Or as we like to say with the straight line system, your prospect must think it's the best thing since sliced bread. This includes both tangible products like cars, boats, houses, food, clothing, consumer products, and all the various services people perform. And also intangible products like ideas and concepts and values and beliefs, or any vision you might have for the future. Over the years, I've found the simplest and most effective way to explain the three tens is to imagine a continuum of certainty, meaning a long, thin, straight line with a one on one end of the line and a ten on the other. Now, on the very right end of the continuum, you have the number 10. This represents your prospect being in a state of absolute certainty about the value and efficacy of your product. Or put more simply, your prospect absolutely loves it. For example, if you were to ask this prospect what they thought about your product, a dead honest answer would sound something like, "Oh my God, it's literally the best thing since sliced bread. Not only does it fill all my needs, but it's also a great value for the money. I can only imagine how great I'm going to feel when I get to use it in the future. It'll be like having a huge weight lifted off my shoulders." That's a 10 on the certainty scale. Your prospect absolutely loves your product, and they're damn sure of it. Then, over on the very left end of the continuum, you have the number 1. This represents your prospect being in a state of absolute uncertainty about the value and efficacy of your product. Or put more simply, they think it's a total piece of shit. In this case, if you were to ask your prospect the same question as above, they would say something along the lines of, "That product of yours is the biggest piece of shit I've ever seen in my life. In fact, not only is it completely overpriced, but it also looks like shit, works like shit, feels like shit, and it's actually built like shit. So the sooner you get that piece of shit out of my sight, the happier I'll be." That's a 1 on the certainty scale. Your prospect absolutely despises your product, and it's going to be difficult to change their mind. Then, along the continuum's middle, you have the varying degrees of certainty between a 1 and a 10, with number 5 representing a state of pure ambivalence. That's where your prospect isn't leaning one way or the other. In normal sales parlance, this is referred to as your prospect sitting on the fence, an expression specifically meant to highlight the delicate nature of this state. However, with the straight line system, we view a 5 in a far more positive light. In fact, to a seasoned straight liner, a prospect who is at a 5 has a big sign on their chest saying, "Please influence me now. I can't make up my mind, so please help me." The important thing to remember here is that while being at a 5 does indeed mean that your prospect is 50-50 on your product, it does not mean that you only have a 50-50 chance of closing them. The same thing goes for levels 3 and 7 on the certainty scale, which are basically mirror images of each other. In the case of a 3, your prospect thinks that your product is basically crap, although not nearly as crappy as if they were at a 1. And at a 7, your prospect thinks your product is great, although not nearly as great as if they were at a 10. In both of those cases, however, whether your prospect is at a 7 or a 3, there are two important things to remember. First, your prospect's feelings of certainty or uncertainty are less set in stone than if they were at the level to the right or the left of them. Secondly, their presence at either level does not directly translate into a better or worse chance of ultimately closing them. In other words, their current state of certainty is just that, current. It is not permanent, and they are eagerly waiting to be influenced by you. Now, when it comes time to ask for the order, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that the closer you've gotten your prospect to a 10, the better chance you have of closing them. On the other hand, the farther away your prospect is from a 10, the worse chance you have of closing them. From a practical standpoint, if your prospect is anywhere below a 5, you have basically no chance of closing them. The reason for this has to do with something called positive intent, which serves as the very foundation from which all human beings make their decisions. In other words, human beings don't buy things that they think will make their lives worse. They buy things that they think will make their lives better. However, the operative word here is think. You see, just because someone has positive intent doesn't necessarily mean that the resulting decisions will end up having a positive impact on them. In fact, with many people, it often doesn't. Their lives are punctuated by a series of self-defeating decisions. However, even these serial bad decision makers believe their decisions were good when they made them. That's the definition of positive intent. In consequence, when you ask for the order, if your prospect thinks that your product is shit, then you have absolutely no chance of closing them. Conversely, if they think the opposite is true, that your product is the best thing since sliced bread, then you have an excellent chance of closing them. It's basic logic, right? So let me ask you this. Let's say you've just made an absolutely kick-ass sales presentation to a financially qualified prospect who needs your product, wants your product, and has also been feeling a bit of pain as a result of an unfulfilled need that your product perfectly meets. In addition, let's also say that your sales presentation was so on target that when you asked your prospect for the order, they were at a 10 on the certainty scale and damn sure of it. My question is, will the prospect buy from you? Yes or no? The obvious answer is yes, isn't it? Before you answer the question, I want you to know that I've laid out this same scenario to audiences all over the world and posed that very same question. When I ask the people in the audience to raise their hands if they think a prospect will buy from them under those circumstances, every hand in the room goes flying up. It doesn't matter where I am in the world, how large the audience is, or how much sales experience they have. Unless they've been taught the straight line system, their hands always go up. And that's when I deliver the punchline. I say, really? Well, guess what? You're all wrong. The correct answer is maybe. Maybe they will, and maybe they won't. You see, I was purposely being a bit coy with you before, and I left out one crucial point from that scenario I laid out. What if the prospect doesn't trust you? For instance, let's say that during your sales presentation, you accidentally said something or did something that rubbed the prospect the wrong way, to the point where they no longer trusted you. What are the chances of them buying from you then? I'll tell you what they are. Zero. Nothing. Zilch. Plain and simple. If your prospect doesn't trust you, then there's absolutely no way they're going to buy from you. And again, I don't care how certain they are about your product, they still won't buy from you. In fact, if they're that intent on purchasing your product, then they'll simply find someone else who sells the same thing, a salesperson they trust, and they'll buy it from that salesperson instead. It's as simple as that. So, that's what makes up the second of the three tens. You. The three tens. One, the product idea or concept. Two, they trust and connect with you. For example, do they think you're a likable, trustworthy person who is not only an expert in your field, but also pride yourself on putting your customers' needs first and making sure that if any problems arise, you'll be right there on the spot to resolve them? That would be a 10 on the certainty scale. Or do they think you're an unlikable snake in the grass, a stone-cold novice who will stick the knife in their back the moment they turn it from you, because all you care about is extracting the maximum amount of commission out of the deal and then moving on to the next target as quickly as possible? That will be a 1 on the certainty scale. And in between those two extremes, you have all the varying degrees of certainty as you move up and down the scale. For example, maybe the prospect thinks you are reasonably trustworthy, but they just don't like you very much. Maybe you broke rapport with them as a result of something you said during your sales presentation. Or perhaps it happened even earlier than that, at the moment the prospect first laid eyes on you. Maybe there was something about the way you looked or the way you shook their hand or how much eye contact you made that turned the prospect off and hence stopped you from falling into a deep state of rapport with them. Or maybe it was the way you asked questions when you were trying to gather intelligence to identify their needs and values and to see if they were financially qualified. Perhaps you came off as the grand inquisitor type, asking questions with a sort of laser-guided focus that makes people feel like you care more about maximizing your commission than resolving their pain. Whatever the case, my point is that in the same way that you have varying degrees of certainty for how the prospect feels about your product, there are also varying degrees of certainty for how the prospect feels about you. In consequence, if you want your prospect to say yes when you ask for the order, then you're going to need to have them as close to a 10 as possible for both of those things, you and your product. Now let me ask you this. Let's say that you're able to get your prospect to a level very close to a 10 for both things. Will they buy from you then? Yes or no? Hopefully you've caught on by now, and you figured out that the answer will be the same as last time, which was maybe, as in maybe they will and maybe they won't. You see, like last time, I left out one very crucial point from the scenario. Namely, what if your prospect doesn't trust the company you work for? For example, let's say your prospect read something very negative about your company, something that led them to believe that the company might not stand behind the product you're offering, or that they would get poor customer service if any problems arose. What are the chances of them buying from you under that circumstance? They're slim and nil, and slim, as they say, left town. It's really quite simple. If your prospect doesn't trust the company you work for, then there's absolutely no way they're going to buy from you, so long as you continue to work there or until you can convince them otherwise. And again, I don't care how certain they are about the first two tens. They will simply not buy from you if they think the company you work for will ultimately try to screw them. So that's what makes up the third of the three tens. The three tens. One, the product idea or concept. Two, they trust and connect with you. Three, the prospect must trust and connect with the company. In fact, this is why it's so much easier to sell to existing customers than to new ones, even if you don't have a personal relationship with them. The fact that they have an existing relationship with your company means that the third ten has already been established, leaving you with only the first and the second tens to address. Now, if you work for a Fortune 500 company with an impeccable reputation, then the chances are extremely high that your prospect will walk into the sale already at a very high level of certainty for the third 10. That's plainly obvious, right? However, what's not quite as obvious is that in addition to having the third 10 established, there's also an extremely high likelihood that your prospect will walk into the sale feeling a very high level of certainty for the first and second 10s as well. In other words, before you even open your mouth, the prospect is also going to be inclined to trust you, because reputable companies choose their employees carefully and take the time to train them. And the product you're offering as well, because reputable companies have too much to lose selling low-quality products. Conversely, if you're working for a company that has a questionable reputation, then your prospects are going to enter the sales encounter at far lower levels of certainty. In fact, depending on how bad that reputation is, you can find yourself fighting a serious uphill battle with your prospects, as many of them will be entering the sales encounter with a certainty level below 3. Lastly, if you're working for a small company whose reputation is neither good nor bad, but simply unknown, that will have little impact on where your prospect enters the encounter on the certainty scale, other than the usual skepticism that's created by dealing with a company that you've never heard of before. Whichever the case, the most important thing to remember is that your prospect will always enter the sales encounter at some point on the certainty scale. Just where? Who really knows? After all, we're not mind readers. However, what we do know is that your prospect will definitely be somewhere on the scale, because they haven't just arrived from outer space or crawled out from under a rock. Your prospect has been living right here on planet Earth, which means that they will have had at least some type of experience with the type of product you're selling and the industry you're in. For example, let's say you're a car salesman working in a Mercedes dealership. Even if your prospect has never driven or even sat in a Mercedes before, you wouldn't expect them to react like one of those shrieking chimpanzees in 2001 A Space Odyssey and start jumping up and down on the hood as if trying to make sense of some completely foreign object. Get the picture? My point here is that no matter what product you're selling, Whether your prospect walks in your door or answers your cold call or clicks on your website, they will always enter the encounter with a preconceived notion about you, about your product, and about the company you work for. You see, we all arrive at any particular moment in time with a history of beliefs and values and opinions and experiences and victories and defeats and insecurities and decision-making strategies. And then, based on all of that stuff, our brain, working at near light speed, will instantly relate it to whatever scenario lies before it. Then, based on the result, it will place us at whatever point on the certainty scale it deems appropriate for each of the three tens. And it's from that starting point that we can then be influenced. Now, if you think that sounds a bit complicated, have no fear. I promise you that it's not. In fact, once you become even reasonably proficient with the straight line system, you'll be able to take any prospect, regardless of where they started off on the certainty scale, and move them to higher and higher levels of certainty with remarkable ease. It will simply be a matter of taking immediate control of the sale and then moving your prospect step by step down the straight line from the open to the close and building massive certainty along the way. Two types of certainty. Before we move forward, there's just one more thing about certainty that I need to fill you in on. Namely, that there are actually two types of it. You have logical certainty and you have emotional certainty. And they're entirely different things. Logical certainty. Logical certainty is based primarily on the words you say. For instance, does the case you've made to the prospect add up on an intellectual level? I'm talking about the actual facts and figures, the features and benefits, and the long-term value proposition as it relates specifically to that prospect. In other words, from a sober, emotionless perspective, does the idea or thesis that you presented to them make sense? Does your product or service truly fill their needs? Is it priced fairly when compared to the competition? Does the cost-benefit ratio make it an unequivocally great deal? When a prospect is feeling logically certain about your product, they can go from start to finish and connect all the dots in the logical case you've made without finding any holes in your story. As a result, they feel confident in their ability to tell the story to someone else and, if necessary, convince that person that they're 100% justified to feel the way they do. That from a purely empirical perspective, the truth is on their side. That's what logical certainty is all about. Emotional certainty. On the flip side, emotional certainty is based on a gut feeling that something must be good. Once it hits us, we feel a craving inside that simply must be fulfilled, even if there's a heavy price to pay for fulfilling it. Unlike logical certainty, emotional certainty has to do with painting your prospect a picture of the future where they've bought your product and can see themselves using the product and feeling good as a result of it. We call this technique future pacing, and it serves as the very backbone of how we move someone emotionally. When you future pace someone, you're essentially playing out the post-buying movie in the best fashion possible, allowing that person to experience your product's amazing benefits right now, along with the positive feelings they create. The prospect's needs have been filled, their pain has been resolved, any itch they had has been scratched, and they're feeling wonderful as a result of it. Now, if you're wondering which of the two kinds of certainty is more important, the answer is they're both important. And they're both absolutely crucial if you want to close at the highest level. You see, people don't buy on logic. They buy on emotion and then justify their decision with logic. The logical mind is analytical by nature. So the more information you give it, the more information it wants to know. In consequence, if you get your prospect to a high level of logical certainty, they'll say, "It sounds great. Let me think about it." Or, "Let me do a bit of research and I'll call you back." However, if you skip making the logical case and focus strictly on creating emotional certainty, it won't do the trick either, because the logical mind serves as a human bullshit detector. It stops us from being swept away by our emotions if things don't add up logically. In consequence, if you want to close at the highest level, then you're going to have to create both types of certainty, logical and emotional, which is precisely what you'll be doing as you move your prospect down the straight line from the open to the close. More on this later, lots more. So let me sum things up for you one last time before we take the next step forward. Plain and simple, if you've been able to move your prospect to a very high level of certainty, both types of certainty, for each of the three tens, then you have an excellent shot of closing them. Conversely, if even one of those three tens has not been lined up, then you have no shot of closing them at all. However, to be clear, when I say no shot, I don't mean that the prospect will hit you with an outright no. In fact, when you're following the principles of the straight line system, you will almost never hear the word no, except at the very beginning of the sale, when you're first introducing yourself or when you're qualifying the prospect. At those points in the sale, you will hear the word no, and that's absolutely fine. In fact, it's an important aspect of the straight line system, as one of its cornerstone philosophies is that we do not make a full-blown sales presentation to someone who is not interested in buying what we're selling. Instead, we want to weed these people out as quickly as possible during the intelligence gathering phase. More on that later. Remember, it's not the job of salespeople to turn no's into yeses. It's simply not what they do. Instead, we turn "let me think about it" into a yes, and "let me call you back" into a yes, and "I need to speak to my wife" into a yes, and "it's a bad time of year" into a yes. In traditional sales parlance, we refer to these various statements as objections, and they come up mostly in the back end of the sale, after you've asked for the order for the first time. In reality, though, the actual meaning of any particular objection has very little to do with what it states on the surface. You see, at the end of the day, objections are merely smoke screens for uncertainty for one or all of the three tens. In other words, if you ask for the order and your prospect is not high enough on the certainty scale, then they'll throw out a smoke screen in the form of one of the common objections, as opposed to coming clean with you, which would mean revealing specifically which of the three tens was holding them back. Now, there are some exceptions to this, which I'll get to a bit later, but my point is that more than 95% of the time, the common objections are merely ploys on the part of the prospect who would rather bow out of the sale gracefully than have to look the salesperson in the eye and confront them about their lack of certainty concerning the three tens. For example, it's far less confrontational to say, "let me think about it," or "it's a bad time of year," to someone who's just spent the last 10 minutes telling you how wonderful a product is, than to say, "I don't trust you," or "I think your product stinks," or "I don't like your company," or "I can't afford it right now," or "your product seems kind of great, but I'm not 1,000% sure of that, and I simply can't afford to risk being wrong and have my spouse chase me around the house screaming, "I told you so, I told you so." So, to avoid the possibility of a head-on confrontation, the prospect conjures up a little white lie. A special lie. A lie that gives the salesperson just enough false hope to make them think that there's a shot of getting a call back by ending the encounter now without pressing the prospect any further. To that end, the prospect will often start off their objection with a quick one-liner about how much they like your product. For example, the prospect might start with something like, "it sounds pretty good, Jim," or "it seems really interesting, Jim," and then follow it up with, "I just need to speak to my wife first. How about I give you a call back tomorrow?" And with that, the prospect has set themselves up to gracefully bow out of the sale, while the salesperson, if they were naive enough to buy into this charade, has not only eliminated any chance of closing the deal, but has also been set up for a massive pain when they start dawing through the list of callbacks, which consists of people who had no intention of buying in the first place. Before we move on, I just want to dispel any notion you might have that the straight line strategy for handling objections is going to promote, support, or even remotely recommend the use of high-pressure sales tactics in any way whatsoever. Simply put, it won't. You see, what I was talking about before was something entirely different, namely that it serves both the prospect and the salesperson to be honest and forthright with each other during a sales encounter, and that anything else is a complete waste of time. With the straight line system, we don't leave a crucial outcome like honest communication up to chance. We ensure it by making it the sole responsibility of the salesperson, and then providing him or her with a bulletproof formula to achieve that outcome every time. So with that, let's go back to that very Tuesday evening when the idea for the straight line system came bubbling up into my brain. Coincidentally, it was the subject of handling objections that first got me thinking about a better way to train salespeople, and that led me to that groundbreaking statement that every sale is the same. At precisely 7 p.m., the meeting started. It was a meeting that would change the lives of millions of people all over the world, rich and poor alike, and create more top sales producers than every other sales training system combined. Two, inventing the straight line. I'm ready to go all night, I said to the Strattonites threateningly, and slowly I locked eyes with each and every one of them and let each feel the full weight of my stare. They were sitting behind old wooden desks, arranged classroom style, and on each desktop sat a cheap black telephone, a gray-colored computer monitor, and a stack of maybe 100 3x5 index cards that I purchased from Dun & Bradstreet for 22 cents apiece. Each of these cards had the name and phone number of a wealthy investor on it, along with the company they owned and its annual revenue for the prior year. To Danny and me, these D&Bs, as they were called, were as valuable as gold, with every 200 cards yielding 10 qualified leads, from which we would open up between 2 or 3 new accounts. And while those numbers might not seem overly impressive, any broker who did that for 3 straight months would be on pace to make over $2 million per year. And if he did it for a year, he'd be on pace to make more than triple that. Unfortunately, the Strattonites' results hadn't been quite as impressive. In fact, they'd been downright awful. For every 200 D&Bs they dialed through, they were averaging only 5 leads, and from those 5, they were closing an average of no one. Ever. So you might as well get comfortable, I continued, because we're not going anywhere until we figure this out. So let's start by getting brutally honest. I want you guys to tell me why you're finding it so hard to close rich people, because I really don't get it. I shrugged. I'm doing it, Danny is doing it, and I know that you guys can do it too. I flashed him a hint of a sympathetic smile. It's like you have some sort of mental block against this, and it's time to break it down. So let's start by you guys telling me why this is so hard for you. I really want to know. A few moments passed as I just stood there at the front of the room looking holes through the Strattonites, who seemed to be literally shrinking in their seats under the weight of my stare. They were a motley crew, all right. There was no denying that. It was a miracle that any of these clowns had even passed their broker's exam. Finally, one of them broke the silence. There are too many objections, he whined. I'm getting hit with them left and right. I can't even get a pitch off. Me too, added another. There are thousands of objections. I can't get a pitch off either. It's a lot harder than with penny stocks. Exactly, added a third one. I'm getting smashed with objections. He let out a deep sigh. I vote for penny stocks too. Same here, added another. It's the objections. They don't let up. The rest of the Strattonites began nodding their heads in agreement as they muttered their collective feelings of disapproval under their breath. But I wasn't the least bit fazed. With the exception of that one reference about voting, as if this were a fucking democracy, I heard it all before. In fact, since the day we made the switch, the brokers had been complaining about the increased number of objections and how difficult they were to overcome. And while there was some degree of truth to it, it wasn't nearly as difficult as they were making it out to be. Not even close. There are thousands of objections? Give me a break. For a moment, I considered taking immediate action against the rabble-rousing Strattonite, who'd mentioned the V-word, but I decided against it. It was time to call these guys out on their bullshit, once and for all. Fair enough, I said with a hint of sarcasm. Since you guys are so sure about these thousands of objections, I want to list every single one of them right now. And with that, I turned to the whiteboard and grabbed a black magic marker off the ledge of the stand and raised it to the center of the board. Go ahead, I continued. Start calling them all out, and then I'll rattle off all the answers to you one by one so you can see how easy this is. Come on, let's go. The Strattonites began to shift uncomfortably in their seats. They looked utterly dumbfounded, like a family of deer caught in the headlights, but not nearly as cute. Come on, I pressed. Speak now or forever hold your peace. I want to think about it, one finally yelled. Good, I replied, and I wrote the objection on the whiteboard. He wants to think about it. That's a great start. Keep going. He wants you to call back, shouted another. Okay, I replied, writing that one down too. Wants a callback. What else? Send me some information. Okay, that's a good one, I remarked, jotting it down as well. Keep going. I'll make it easy and we'll shoot for 1,000. There's only 997 to go. I flashed him a sarcastic grin. It's totally doable. It's a bad time of year, someone yelled. Good, I shot back. Keep going. I need to speak to my wife, yelled another. Or his business partner, shouted yet another. Excellent, I said calmly, writing both objections down. We're making serious progress here. There are only 994 to go. Keep going. I'm not liquid right now, yelled the broker. Ah, now that's a good one, I said quickly, scribbling it down on the board. Although you have to admit that you're not getting that one quite as much since we started calling rich people. Anyway, let's keep going. There are only 993 to go. I only deal with my local broker, one of them yelled. I never heard of your firm before, shouted another. I've been burnt before. I don't like the market right now. I'm too busy. I don't trust you. I don't make quick decisions. And on they went, calling out objection after objection as I wrote each one down in progressively worse handwriting. By the time they were done, I covered the entire surface of the board with every objection they could possibly think of, which at the end of the day turned out to be only 14. That's right. There were only 14 objections, and half of them were variations of two. First, that it was a bad time of year, as in it's tax time, summertime, back to school time, Christmas time, Miller time, Groundhog's Day. And second, that they needed to speak to someone else, as in their spouse, their lawyer, their business partner, their accountant, their local broker, their local soothsayer, their local tooth fairy. What a bunch of crap, I thought. For the last 4 weeks, the Strattonites have been going on and on about how impossible it was to deal with these thousands of objections, to the point where in my darkest hour, they had almost convinced me that they were right, that there were simply too many objections for the average salesperson to handle, and that the success that Danny and I were having was another example of the difference between natural-born closers and everyone else. Yet it had all been a bunch of crap. All at once, I felt my face growing hot. In retrospect, even before I invented the straight line system, I always knew that there wasn't any real difference between one objection and another. But somehow, seeing them all scribbled out on the whiteboard this way highlighted just how interchangeable they all really were. In fact, it was in that very moment that it truly hit me that, at the end of the day, they were all basically the same, that the common objections were nothing more than smokescreens for what was really holding a prospect back, which was a lack of certainty. In fact, now that I thought about it, no matter what objection the prospect hit me with, I would never just answer it and ask for the order again. That would be pointless, since the objection was merely a smokescreen for uncertainty. By itself, in fact, all an answer would do, even a perfect one, is force a prospect to shift to a new objection because the root problem still hadn't been addressed. In consequence, after I answered an objection, I would then loop back to the beginning of the sale and make a follow-up presentation that picked up where my initial presentation had left off, with the goal of increasing the prospect's state of certainty for all three tens. And once again, as with the rest of my strategies, I would execute each one of my loops in precisely the exact same way every